Hello and welcome to This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger, Director of Editorial for Citywire in the US of A, and I'm joined, I think at this point as ever now, by Ian Wenig, Citywire RA Editor. Ian, how's it going?
Doing well. Thank you for having me on as usual, though, you know, I'm not in my usual spot, so this is going to kind of change.
Yeah, we've changed the feng shui of the studio, and we're once again kicking off with some visual references, which will mean nothing on an audio format. But yes, we've swapped seats, basically, is what's happened. But there's a good reason why we've changed the seating around, and it's because we have a special guest joining us today, and that special guest is Mike Durbin, the CEO of Cetera Financial Group. Mike, thank you very much for joining This Week in Wealth.
Delighted to be here, Ian and Alex. Thank you for having me. As another visual cue, it's a very professional setup in here. I'm pleasantly surprised. Somewhere between, I don't know, hopefully maybe Pat McAfee and Crossfire, but we'll see at the result of our conversation.
Those will be the vibes for sure. Yeah. Definitely as controversial as
delighted to be here.
Some of those. Yeah, no, but thank you very much. And I think we've now, this is our third guest of the series, Peter Malouk.
And fourth, Steve Levitt.
Steve Levitt, you did that one by yourself. Okay, so joining an illustrious crew of guests. So look, let's just get straight into it. Ian, you've, as ever, done most of the hard work here and have got a crack list of questions to throw to Mike. And obviously, it's been a very exciting year, generally in wealth management, particularly, I think, in the sort of the broker-dealer space in which you play. So Ian, I'm going to throw straight over to you to get into it, and we'll take it from there.
Awesome, and I'll do this without a net. Basically, what I want to start with is in September, around Labor Day weekend, you guys wrapped up the Advantax conversion. About 3,000 advisors moved over onto your systems that essentially closed the book on, you know, $1.2 billion transaction. What were the biggest moving parts that took place over that conversion? And what were the biggest lessons that you learned from that process that could be informative for future transactions?
Yeah, excellent question. As always, Ian, so thanks for leading off with that. Yeah, the September 5, 6, 7, that weekend was a consequential weekend, as you highlight. It really was the capstone on what has amazingly been our two-year history with the Advantax acquisition. So Cetera took Advantax, its holding company, public. We took them private, from public to private, at the end of 2023. And sort of the conversion phases sort of initiated immediately 2 years ago, but then really concluded with that September weekend. And really what that September weekend represented, as you referenced, was it was this last leg of the most significant part of the transition, which was a little bit into the technicalities. It was lifting nearly 5,000 financial professionals and their teams out of the legacy of Advantax broker-dealer entity into a resultant Cetera broker-dealer entity while retaining Fidelity's NFS clearing capabilities and adopting the AdviceWorks advisor and consumer-facing technology desktop and all the third-party integrations therein. So it really was the most significant infrastructure, technology, entity, operations, and service conversion. There were smaller conversions along the way over the past 2 years, but this was the biggest. And as you represent, you know, really was the capstone to that two-year progress. It's been an incredible, terrific 2 years. We bought a great business, very pleased with how it has evolved, how it maintains its growth momentum. This conversion weekend was a big event. There's no doubt about it. And like any big conversion, there was disruption, you know, because the minute in a layer cake, if you're going to change an advisor's entity, clearing firm, tech stack, things are going to have to be changed. There is friction in there. And so if there are, you know, you specifically asked lessons learned, we do a very specific, with each conversion we do, large or small, we do after action reviews so that the next conversion can always build on the prior and sort of get better. So we're in the throes of our after action review now. The two biggest sort of
themes, what's the feedback so far?
The two biggest themes coming out of this one would be because we knew that this was a big transition, there are a number of things that we were going to change within the business. We would have changed over the last 2 years. We waited until the conversion weekend. And so we sort of added to the complexity by having a lot of the change initiated through that weekend being in addition to just the threshold conversion. Policy changes, pricing changes, product access changes. We sort of said, look, let's do it all as part of the conversion. I don't know if we would have necessarily done that differently looking back, but it was a key variable to what drove some of the incremental complexity of that weekend. That's one. Two would be that, and again, sorry to be in the weeds, but that resultant setup, now that they're within the four walls of Cetera formally and finally, the Cetera broker-dealer entity, utilizing Fidelity NFS for clearing and AdviceWorks as the technology value proposition, that was a new environment for Cetera. And so that environment was up and in production with pilot Avantax users for several months in advance of the conversion weekend. But when you have 5,000 professionals come across the transom in a weekend, it sort of exposed that the newness of the environment, it was new to the service representatives on the other end of the call with the Avantax rep. And looking back, that was not ideal, right? And so pleased to report.
So the people guiding them weren't as au fait with the environment.
They were sort of like, this is sort of new to us also. And so we're learning. We've gotten through all of that transition, sort of friction between then and now. And we see it empirically in, service levels, handle times, abandon rates, first call resolution. I mean, we maniacally measure, sort of the metrics is sort of the blood flow of how is the activity coursing through the system. And so, we feel good that we are getting ourselves into what we would call business as usual sort of BAU stance. There is a tail of issues that we continue to pursue, to continue to improve upon the resultant environment in which they've all been transitioned. But like any transition, we sort of, sort of an industry standard, you may say that, hey, the destination you're going to is 70% better, 30% same or worse, but it's 100% new. So everything has to be learned. So we're working our way through that.
And it's a little bit of a basic question, but it's a 2-year process then you've been through then. How does this period that you're talking about now compare in sort of, I don't know how you want to choose to measure this, but the difficulty versus, the various stages of the deal? What for you is the most stressful part? Is it, actually closing the deal? I'm sure there were other firms who were looking at Avantax that you had to, beat to get it.
It's an excellent question.
Something that I suppose there's also there's just the recruitment phase, which we'll come on to
for sure
with regards to other companies. But we know that once you do a deal for a bunch of brokers, there's blood in the water and, you've done it yourself. Yeah. Other brokers will go, hang on, we'll have some of that. And then, then there's the sort of kind of in the weeds operational technology side, which sounds tough sledding to me, but which, as the man seeing over that, what's the hardest?
The two most consequential moments in any transaction are those two bookends. It's when you announce the deal, that is the signal to the market that there's going to be some level of transition. And so
Disruption they could take.
There's some disruption that's coming. So by the time particularly a large acquisition like this, particularly take private transaction, which is also carries its own complexity, by the time there's an announcement, a lot of planning is already well underway. As soon as that announcement is made, you have to be ready to be able to articulate to those advisors, what is the future going to look like? What might it mean to them, financially, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the critical bookend. Then it's this last bookend. It's whatever that last bookend represents, the formal conversion to whatever that resultant future state is going to be. Yes, there's almost two critical years in between, but the environment settles in that period in between. There's still activity, I'm sure, with our advisors along the way. But part of our success of Avantax since that announcement, it's manifest through terrific retention and organic growth of those Avantax advisors. And so obviously we're maniacally focused on maintaining that momentum post this last leg of the conversion over the September weekend.
Yeah, you don't want that to go to waste with tech and op stuff.
You got it.
What was the retention rate roughly then of the?
It's in line with the overall Cetera run rate retention, which is between 97% to 98% right now, which is, really terrific. We don't, if people ask what keeps you up at night, that's the metric, the
retention.
We have a lot of really good momentum around flow growth, recruiting growth. But look, that only matters in the context of we're retaining whom we have. That really is the key to building good, sustainable organic growth.
That's a good segue, I think, to some what you have next on your list.
Yeah. What is kind of the, from a resource management perspective, I mean, how do you kind of divide time, energy, resources between retention efforts versus going out and recruiting and bringing in net new assets? So, you know, is there a level of compartmentalization that takes place there? So how do you guys find the, strike the right balance between those two?
Yeah, good question. There's a distinct different group orientation value proposition for recruiting. There are people dedicated to that. The way in which we drive good retention outcome is just the entire rest of the company. Are we keeping the promise of having channels and communities alive? Are we actually, you know, putting skin in the game with the growth resources right at the line of scrimmage that an advisor needs to win the next household? Are we being as responsive as quickly as locally as we can to a service escalation or a product request or an ad review? So, I mean, it sounds a little squishy, but there's no distinct team or playbook for retention writ large. There are tactics for retention of a deal, but for the retention profile for overall Cetera, it's us putting our money where our mouth is to help drive our advisors' growth. That is the most retentive thing we can do day in and day out. And we're seeing really good results with that right now.
Just looking out at a macro level on the brokerage business, I mean, look, the conventional wisdom is that the brokerage business is a much lower margin business than traditional wealth management assets. I mean, you guys are at $625 billion in total AUA. 284 of that is kind of traditional advisory assets under management. From a business perspective, is there pressure to convert some of those brokerage assets into fee-based advisory assets? And in terms of how your business is constructed, I mean, how much of a contributor to your firm's overall margin is that $284 billion in traditional advisory assets?
Yeah. I mean, the advisory assets, you know, on a unit economics basis, they are marginally more profitable than a brokerage asset, just as you said. Now, there's always caveats. Depends upon the market environment, the volume, you know, et cetera. Brokerage can be, you know, a lucrative business also. But, you know, across market cycles, all things being equal, of course, the marginal flow through dollar of profitability is higher on advisory versus brokerage. But for a firm like Cetera, while, yes, we are continuing to drive more aggregate assets to advisory assets, as you referenced, when you asked, is there pressure? There's no sort of external pressure to do so. What's guiding us is that it is just a winning value proposition for advisors to go to their households with a financial planning-based relationship orientation that gets largely implemented through an advisory solution. I say largely because Cetera, we will never be a firm by choice that will be 100% advisory. Because we have a firm, strategic, long-term embrace of what I call strategic transactional business. We're heavy in insurance. We do alternatives on a placement basis as well as advisory. We have advisors that want to do fixed income on a sales credit basis, not charge a fee. Right? So we are just very long-term bullish. We like to call on a super hybrid model, which is, yes, the core of your business could be planning-based, implemented, the anchor to Windward in an advisory context, but be able to tap into tax planning and prep, insurance-based risk solutions, trust and estate planning. So you will see us have a significant and strategic brokerage, non-advisory asset base, because we think it's delivering real value ultimately to the households we serve.
Okay, but like over time, do you still see that portion of your assets that is advisory growing as a percentage of the overall business
for both
client-based reasons, better deal for the client and thus maybe for the advisor's business, but also ultimately for your own bottom line and
For sure. For three principal catalysts on my mind. One is more and more advisors are figuring out that being financial planning based is just a better long-term sort of value prop for the households they serve. Implementing that is easier through an advisory proposition than transactional is the experience. That's sort of one. These are all related, of course. Number two is more and more advisors sort of figuring out that their capacity is increased, their position in the relationship is augmented, the more they outsource money management to third parties versus do it themselves. We have great relationships with managed account platforms like Envestnet, Orion, et cetera. So that's fueling the continued sort of advisory mix for sure. And then third is, which, you know, Ian, you've covered quite well, we are increasingly investing in and driving growth through our more RIA-centric channel and communities. And so there continues to be this trend towards more RIA-centric business models and affiliation models, which will drive more advisory assets versus brokerage, all else equal.
Because I would say, like, you know, and again, this is high level and we haven't had these firm CEOs in the studio, so they might say otherwise, but our sense would be, looking at some of your peers in that space, they would seem to be emphasizing that part of their business more, in some cases doing some quite expensive deals. Actually, I don't know why I'm hedging the names here. Like, Zayg spent an awful lot of money on that one RIA. Obviously, what LPL is maybe doing around some of its OSJs and things, it does seem to be that, you know, they're doing a lot of work to grow that part of their business.
Yeah, philosophically, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, we at Cetera, with our board, our ownership group, you know, which is represented through Genstar Capital, we all see the world the same way, which is the distinct advantage of Cetera. We do not have to pick winner and loser business models or affiliation models. We have the requisite scale in place to continue to build out the range of affiliation models that we can support. And so, you know, we have plenty of legacy 1099 independent contractor hybrid business models that are going to continue to grow and thrive just like that forever. There are some of those 1099 practices want to be increasingly RIA. We can facilitate that. There are some that are selling their practice to our W-2 RIA community as a form of their sort of succession. And we want to just continue to sort of foster all that optionality in a consumable, rational way without picking winners and losers. You know, we are putting our money where our mouth is to seek to be a forever home for our advisors, including when they're ready to monetize their business, sell, and move on. And a lot of those kinds of sort of destinations and affiliation models are increasingly leaning towards RIA, but not all into RIA only. It's not to the exclusion of.
So given those kind of dynamics that you've described, especially on the succession planning, where does the retirement planning group, and for listeners who don't know what TRPG is, that is a fee-only RIA that is owned by Cetera itself, which has carried out several RIA acquisitions. Where do you see TRPG fitting in as a succession vehicle, a way that can keep those assets and advisors on the platform through a multi-generation transfer event?
Yeah, it is a threshold component of our succession solution value proposition. So like other firms, maybe in our category, buying large RIAs, you know, that the Cetera bought TRPG in the spring of 2023. It was a reasonably small, you know, RIA. It was purchased as much as a capability acquisition, certainly not a scale acquisition, at $1.4 billion of assets. It has grown really nicely under the ownership of Cetera. Three vectors of growth. It's getting its own organic growth because it's a really good fee-only RIA emanating out of Leawood, Kansas, which is like the Wall Street of all things RIA these days.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? It's crazy.
There's something in the water in Kansas City. So it's growing extremely well on its own organically, but it is affecting internal succession deals at an increasing velocity on increasing size of deal. And then the third vector in is they're also able to acquire and recruit outside in to TRPG, whether as just a hire or a succession deal. So a practice that might be somewhere else where TRPG becomes the outside in succession deal, but also our inside succession deal for a Cetera practice. So we're really, really delighted with how that's evolved over the last 2 years.
And I'm sorry, forgive me if this is a stupid question, but sort of Mothership Cetera would fund that.
Yes. Yeah, so we're the capital partner
to buy out the retiring advisor.
Exactly right. Okay. And it's one of our two acquired W-2 REAs. The other one is Avantax Planning Partners, which was the W-2 REA that came as part of the bigger Avantax transaction. It had the same value proposition within Avantax. It was a succession deal. It was, you know, for those that want to transition, if it wasn't succession, even just a transition to more of an RIA-centric model. So we really love that we have those two, our lingo, communities within our RIA and channels and branches channel as an option, you know, for those practices.
So Ian, forgive me if I'm going to steal your next question, but I feel like this is a neat segue. In fact, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to tee up you to ask the question.
I want you to ask.
This feels like a neat segue then. We're talking about sort of succession planning. We're also talking about backing and things. So talk about sort of where Cetera then is as a company. You mentioned obviously your long-term relationship with Genstar. What's the easiest way of asking this question? Just directly, you know, what's the goal here? What are you driving towards the next monetization event for those backers? Is it the much fabled but rarely seen wealth management IPO? Is it, you know, another strategic acquirer, sort of mega merger?
Yeah. I ask him this every year. Now you get to ask it a different way.
Okay, good. I imagine you get a really good, clean, very honest, straightforward answer every year.
Then I can still give the same answer I've been giving Ian the last couple of years, which is, given where we are, and I'll come back to it, in our investment cycle, we don't have to worry about that question right now. So we operate on the basis of keep our heads down and grow the company. Because Genstar Capital, while they are concluding their seventh year of ownership of Cetera, that clock was fundamentally restarted just under 2 years ago with the fundamental re-underwrite. So Genstar Capital, their funds 7 and 8, sold Cetera to their most recent funds 10 and 11. That resets the capital stack and the clock. So we have a very long runway, and we operate on the basis of drive growth. So theoretically, what lies ahead? It's the usual suspects of three outcomes. You know, another sponsor or multiple sponsors, a strategic would come over the top, or an IPO. And so our role is to grow the company, take advantage of what we think is our distinct advantage right now, which is being private in a consolidating market where there's a lot of disruption and change that's happening. It's better to be private than public right now, and lift our head later when we, Genstar, come to the conclusion that maybe a different form of ownership is ideal. But we just don't have to be. We don't have to be burdened in answer those questions.
Because everyone asks. But what we do have to ask them.
For sure.
Because,
for sure.
You guys cover extremely well.
I mean, sorry to interrupt. I mean, I'm passionate that it's best to be private in this environment. There's multiple ways to go private. We're private through private equity. But then the next big factor is not all private equity is created equal. We have a terrific sponsor that knows the industry and knows Cetera. They've been through a pandemic. They've been through the interest rate cycle. So they just have deep experience and knowledge and perspective on the business. And we see the future the same way. So we're heads down being aggressive. Just very, very fortunate to have them as a strategic partner as much as capital partner.
So, I mean, one thing that we've written about a lot this year, especially aggressively, has been the debt capital markets and how many firms of a similar size and scale have pursued debt raises this year for various reasons, sometimes fund acquisition, sometimes debt refinancing. I'm curious, you know, how you view a business like yours should be positioned from a leverage position, both for, you know, pursuing incremental M&A, as we've discussed, or I like to discuss frequently, internal CapEx, but also kind of managing the risk of a downturn. Like this is something that Fielding Miller and I talked about. And he said he wasn't really comfortable getting up to
Fielding Miller, CapTrust CEO, just for
those who aren't fully aware. But I'm just curious, like, what is kind of a sustainable leverage ratio for a business like yours, and what are the preparations you guys have made to withstand a downturn?
Yeah, our capital stack, equity and debt, is purpose built for the long-term strategic plan that we're executing right here. We're very comfortable with the level of leverage we have today. Moody's and S&P, through their annual cycles, have just reaffirmed, you know, their outlooks and ratings, you know, for Cetera. So we feel good about the capital stack. It's purpose-built for what we're endeavoring to do. To your point, Ian, the level of debt that firms like ours carry in private equity form, it is, all things being equal, higher than the public company peers. Public companies sort of would have a harder time carrying a level of debt, you know, that we can carry in private form, but we're able to do more with that capital stack and realize returns for our equity investors, which includes hundreds of our own advisors, by the way, that are holding the equity. So we're quite comfortable with the capital stack. Again, this notion of not all private equity is created equally. You know, over 7 years, Genstar has not taken any money out of Cetera. No dividend recap. They don't charge a fee. And so while big box M&A like Avantax, where we started, you know, commands a lot of the headlines, the reality is we've done over 40 M&A transactions in the last 2 years, 80 in the last 5 years. We've not tapped the revolver.
We've only gone outside to the outside markets for capital when it's something very significant. Avantax was the last one. That Avantax transaction catalyzed the re-underwrite that occurred 2 years ago. That was all done simultaneously. We did the Concourse acquisition. We've kept up this pace of recruiting. That's a record year of recruiting. We have not needed any additional outside capital because of the cash flow generative potential pistons that are already at play within the company. So we feel pretty good.
So this again, unfair question. You probably get a lot, but now you've mentioned that you've got that back, you've got that funding. You've mentioned that it's a sort of this is an opportunity for consolidation in this space, and you've just to some degree, not ever fully, but sort of finished this 2 year cycle with Avantax. That was your last mega deal. Obviously, you mentioned scores of others as well. Are you looking now for something else of a similar size?
I mean, we're always looking. You know, at Cetera, we like to say that M&A is not a side hustle. I mean, it is a fundamental, you know, part of our vascular system. We have a dedicated corporate development team, sort of an in-house investment banking capability for sourcing and transaction execution, et cetera. We have specialist M&A legal resources on the legal team. We have a dedicated integrations team. We have a dedicated early service team that's actually handling the service queues so that the rest of the 12,000 are not disrupted because we are a high volume M&A shop. So we are always looking is the reality. But you know, M&A's...
But of that scale again, you know...
Sure. Yeah, we're that what I like, and I, you know, I've been here just under 3 years, so it's a testament to... The longer term Cetera team and Genstar, you know, I say with absolutely zero hubris, I think Genstar or Cetera sees just about everything that comes to market. That's the position.
You
that
and
we
Ian Wenig. He has a pretty good look at it. Well.
Nothing inappropriate, I assure you. But that's a hard earned position in the marketplace that, you know, sort of the sell side, you know, sort of community, they know that they want to get an opportunity in front of Cetera or Genstar, but M&A's mercurial, right? So there's three outcomes. We look at something and choose not to engage. We look at something, engage and lose. We look at something, engage and win. And we got a healthy diet of all three of those over the last 2 years.
Yeah,
and
do you want to talk about constant. Some of the losses? Do you want to sort of, you know, run
no.
through?
No?
Okay, just, you know. I digress. Ian, let's get back to your list.
So just from the financials, we talked about margins a little bit. I'm curious, and we can go as macro as we want on this, to what extent do you see cash sweep economics being a big margin driver? And how has the interest rate environment over the last couple of years changed in terms of making that a margin driver?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, you know our model quite well. We participate heavily in, you know, the economics at the short end of the curve, you know, client, you know, fallow cash sweep economics. It is an important part of our P&L and the cash flow generative pistons in our P&L engine. Having said that, though, we have a very diversified revenue and earnings stream. Team's done an incredible job over years making sure that there's not an over-reliance on those cash sweep economics. So relative to some of our peers, I am very proud of the percentage of our revenue and what we would consider bottom line EBITDA earnings that are coming from other than cash sweep. Having said that, it's an important part of our cash flow generative. So as I said before, we have not needed to incrementally tap capital markets to incrementally fund our growth. It's in large part because we've had this cash flow, you know, set of pistons that's been coursing reasonably well. Look, the short end of the curve, that cycle is turning for sure. It is fully planned in our multi-year plan as well as annual budgeting process. We're very pleased with our hedging strategy around rates and the rate outcome that we have on those installed balances. And by the way, just given the growth, the organic growth that we're getting day in and day out, our cash balances are rising because the aggregate asset base and household base is growing. And so in a rate volume context, you know, volume is holding up, rate will come down, but the cash flow generative potential of the balances will still play that strategic role for us to help continue to fuel our growth.
So we talked a lot about, and we've talked about unit economics, we've talked about high level M&A. I mean, what are some of the challenges that being a company at scale, what are some of the inherent challenges that come with scale? And what are kind of the systems and processes that you guys put in place to manage it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we've talked a lot in the past. I do think scale is condition precedent to be successful in this industry longer term, or let's say take advantage of all the opportunities that still lie ahead for this industry. But I mean, it's a good fair question. What are the pitfalls of scale? I mean, I would say, you know, given that we are so stridently focused on continuing to build the multi-affiliation model approach, foster the differentiation of our various channels and communities, but do it on a scaled basis, common technology backbone, common operations and service backbone. You know, that's where, you know, it can impact just how nimble we can be in one particular community when it's drawing upon a technology or a third-party partner that's being used across the entire enterprise. So the systems we have in place are to really be very explicit about that. Like, how do we make sure that we're able to stay nimble and react and evolve quickly while not doing it on a descaling basis? I mean, look, in this environment, we all watch the Kitsis map, right? There's no shortage of new solutions. It's almost by the week. And I don't know where they are, but I guarantee you today there's a Cetera advisor that has fallen in love with the latest new something. And so we could integrate, you know, nonstop with sort of third-party applications. Our role is to sort of be, we think, a strategic curator of what do we think is the evolving solution set that's going to work, and try, without descaling, try to be able to move nimbly, you know, to integrate the new capabilities that we think are going to be, you know, really sort of help that organic growth profile for our advisors. But it's a good question. We're constantly
not
focused
be left
on
behind
it.
And still let them be small businesses.
Yeah. How do we retain the financial and sort of strategic upside of scale without the operational, you know, sort of friction of descaling?
I thought you were going to ask a different question. I thought you were going to come in and talk about the open letter from earlier in the year.
No, I'm setting that up for you.
It was higher on the list, and we haven't discussed it yet. And I feel it sort of came up organically earlier, perhaps. But yeah, you know, I think that's obviously been I'm not asking you to comment on competitors, but I think we can say, I think it's a matter of record, one of the biggest stories of the year was LPL's acquisition of Commonwealth. Ian Wenick broke the news
with Andrew Forsch,
of course. Yeah, give Andrew credit. Massive story obviously this year. It obviously really shaped that market, and I think in the immediate aftermath of that, we saw a battle, for want of a better phrase, to recruit those what was it 2,300 odd advisors.
Yes,
there. LPL being very bullish, saying, you know, they'll get 90%, although that you're at 97%, so maybe 90 isn't that bullish, I don't know. You put out, whether it's you personally or the company, put out that open letter earlier in the year.
The royal we.
I don't quite know what the question is here. I mean, sort of good decision. Did it pay off? How do you feel about that? How would you feel if someone else did it to you? Is it just it's just fair game? It's just what you have to do in this world.
I mean, look, we're very happy with our current results. You know, that have been catalyzed by that transaction. I think that transaction has a long tail. I think that story is yet to be fully told. In my bookmark, you know, sort of metaphor, that second bookend is a long way off from being placed. And so we can talk more about that. I think 26 will continue to be active. But there is an element of, you know, in a large transaction like that, this is what stirs the industry, you know, to act. We felt compelled to directly communicate in the way that we did because, you know, a number of us, Commonwealth's a terrific firm. Just a number of us know Commonwealth, the ethos of Commonwealth so well. We knew that our channel and community approach, we knew that our multi-affiliation approach, we knew that it would resonate with Commonwealth advisors, but it was important to us to not entrust that message to get out quickly, sort of one conversation at a time with our own recruiters, third-party recruiters, our own advisors, where we have a referral program that if they knew a Commonwealth, so it was really important for us because we knew it would resonate, this notion of channel and community. And look, you know, Commonwealth used the term community a lot over its arc. Cetera's used that term a lot over its arc. We knew that it would resonate. And It is the reality. So yes, it was our sort of starter pistol. Let's get it out there. Let's communicate directly. It catalyzed a lot of activity, but it grounded our approach that, hey, come engage with Cetera. And if we're doing our job, we will shepherd you to the channel and community that's going to be best for you so that you get that benefit of scale, as we just talked about here in a second, but you have a sense of community, affinity of practices just like yours. If I can give you the most obvious proof point, across our five channels, we have a win or an inbound win in all five channels from Commonwealth.
From Commonwealth, okay.
So that to me is, yeah, it works. But it's not an intuitive message. In the moment of hysteria where a Commonwealth team is probably getting a dozen phone calls within minutes, you know, for us to be able to hang and have them stand in the pocket to say, but engage us and let us really understand your practice well enough to be able to shepherd you to the right channel or community we think is a fit for you, it does take a different level of time and communication. We thought we would get out of the gate fastest by communicating it directly. And it's working.
It's been successful.
Well, the follow-up that I have on that, which you probably aren't expecting me to take this route, is, you know, what was the upside to going through the direct approach as opposed to using some of the third-party recruiters? And just from a recruiting perspective, what is the right balance between devoting resources towards sourcing recruits yourself as opposed to contracting out to the third-party recruiters?
I mean, I'll give more substance than this, Ian, of course, and Alex, but you have to do it all. You have to do it all. And so, again, we have unbelievable, terrific relationships with all the right third-party recruiters, and they've been such great partners of Cetera because, you know, they've invested the time to understand our channel and community approach, to understand our forever home value proposition, to understand that a practice can come into Cetera in one particular form or channel and can evolve to another one through time. That takes a minute to understand. So we gravitate and invest behind the third party recruiters that have put the sweat equity into understanding our value prop. So I trust implicitly the third party recruiting partners we use. They are communicating our value prop in the right way in the industry. We just thought in the case of such a seismic moment like that transaction, it was important that we sort of set that sort of first, that first plank in the outreach to Commonwealth. But we went after Commonwealth with every vector and resource of recruiting that we have, you know. But again, we will conclude 2025 as a record year of recruiting in Cetera's history. It'll be a 60%+ increase year over year alone. But the Commonwealth business is in the minority. Yeah, we're recruiting from all channels, you know, sort of all spots at the moment. But yes, like everyone in the industry, when there's a catalyzing moment, like a big transaction, we respond.
So I have a couple of questions. One less fair than the other.
I don't know where it's going with this.
Unfair one first. Subtext here, though, you looked at the Commonwealth business and you thought that I'm not saying you did look at it, but if culturally you saw those two businesses as being, could have been quite a good fit.
Did I see those two as a good cultural fit?
I guess really what I'm asking a question that you can't answer, I suppose, here. But had you acquired Commonwealth, you would have thought that would have been quite a good cultural fit. You sort of mentioned, you know, the advisors, the communities, the alignment between those two businesses could have looked attractive.
Oh, yeah. Yes, this is the short answer. I mean, there would have been a strong cultural affinity between our two firms, for sure. And look, there's a proof point. We're welcoming a lot of those advisors into, you know, Cetera. So, yeah.
And then the other one, which is more sort of smaller scale or whatever, you mentioned you have this sort of advisor referral program. So if an advisor who sort of knows another advisor who's in Commonwealth gets them in, is that common generally? Do advisors as a whole, do you have sort of referral programs?
I mean, I don't know.
Do they get some sort of incentive generally for recruiting other advisors?
They do. Yeah, there's a small incentive if they do that. It's an important, you know, sort of conduit for our recruiting. And interesting, it's one of our highest close rates on the recruit because...
Because
they know each other. There's an implied understanding and trust factor and awareness. You know, so there are several, but our key primary four conduits for recruiting will be our own, we call sort of demand center, our own demand generation into the advisor community to sort of contact us. Second, is we have our own dedicated recruiting staff. Third would be third-party recruiters. that we talked about. And fourth would be the advisor referral. And we get good leads, good business from all four. And again, it's Ian, back to your question, you need to use your full portfolio of resources and vectors, to be successful at recruiting and retention.
Okay, yeah, and then that wasn't a specific thing just for Commonwealth. So that existed already.
That existed already.
Okay, that wasn't like, we're going to roll this out.
That's been in place.
Okay, got it, understood. Ian, I feel we should sort of go softer at this point. Not that we've actually been particularly hard, but I feel like it's
it's good.
We're in the holidays.
These are the issues.
We're winding up. I feel we should throw some gentler things, but I don't want to disrupt the list before we do that.
Well, maybe just from
baseball season's over. There's nothing gentle to talk about with Ian.
it's all elbows and yeah.
Well, just from a macro, macro perspective, I've been going macro a lot in this episode. What do you see as kind of, if you had to do a SWOT analysis for the IBD industry as a whole, what do you see as the biggest threats and opportunities?
It's a good question. I'm going to sound like I'm playing my own hand. I don't see many macro threats to those players that either have the scale and are leaning into it or have their sights set on, getting to sort of a scale effect. I think the future is quite strong. I think the opportunity is, I think the opportunity is largely manifest in what we're endeavoring to do in this market is to continue to invest and grow our place in the market on a basis of not picking winners and losers. Be able to bring that scale effect to foster the optionality that independent advisors want to explore all the time. There are very few practices that I've run across in a long career that get into the industry in a particular form and exit it in the same form. And the opportunity is, how do we evolve with those practices and never have to leave the four walls? And that's up to and including an outright sale and or a full conversion to a W-2 RIA, whether it's their own or on ours. There's incredible opportunity for our industry in there. The second close related is that, look, there's incredible businesses being built. Some of them have been on this podcast that are fee only, integrated, single value prop, growing really, really nicely. It's terrific. We have a long-term embrace of this sort of super hybrid notion. We will be fee and advisory. We do embrace insurance as risk-based products to implement a fulsome financial plan. We're active in the retirement space. We're active in the transactional brokerage space. We own a trust company. We own an insurance, broker's general agent. Those are all elements of being able to implement a full household balance sheet solution. And we're going to stay very, very focused on that. That's replete with opportunity in our view.
So what does stress you out? What does keep you up? Whether it's, I'm not saying not a competitor, you're happy with what you're offering. You don't see it as a one or the other. We're all of it. I was going to say like a market downturn, but if that feels a bit obvious, and there's nothing you could do about that. But what are the sort of, maybe keeps you up is a too strong a phrase, but what are your sort of,
it's a good question. We've hit on some of them. I mean, it is a junkyard dog competitive market in which we're operating. So it'd be naive not to acknowledge that it's competitive. So, we certainly, all stay on the edge of our seat there at the moment. I like how we're sort of behaving, in a competitive market, but you can't take it for granted. That's one. Two would be, Ian, as you referenced in your question, I do worry that the scale effect we're getting through size, because size and scale are not the same thing. We're getting a scale benefit through our size. We have to ensure that scale benefit continues to be productive and on offense and does not emerge as slowing us down, for sure. And then the third would be, are we keeping up with just the unrelenting collapse of product cycles? Tech cycles, investment product cycles. I mean, I'm old enough. I used to work for organizations that would put new technology out into an advisor ecosystem, and you have a realistic expectation it'll last 7 to 10 years. That became 5 to 7, 3 to 5. Now it's 1 to 3, and it's probably going to go 6 to 9 months. At some point, like there's just this unrelenting innovation and expectation that what is on offer is constantly at the vanguard. And again, we can keep up with that right now, but I worry that we have to be able to stay, just, you know, continue, sort of at
it's
that
treadmill, effectively.
Yeah. And not because we want to be at the bleeding edge of every new innovation, but just continue to meet or exceed the expectations of our advisor base and their clients. We have to be able to respond as quickly as we can, because there's going to be an acceleration of supply of those solutions. So just our ability to ferret through, curate, diligence, integrate, commercialize, really having that muscle system tuned is going to be important.
Fantastic. Ian, we've got about, actually, we're almost out of time. We've got about a minute left. What else can we throw at Mike before?
1 minute left. Oof, you're putting a lot of pressure on me. All right, I will ask one good kind of finale question, and that is, which of your advisor affiliation models do you think are in position to disproportionately win in the future? In other words, as you see advisor demographics change and advisor desires change, which of your channels, this also gives you a chance to give a quick explainer of all five, which channels do you think are best positioned to meet advisors where they're going?
Ian, he's not going to pick winners or losers. Come on. It's very clear. This is the one thing that I've got from this.
I defer to Alex on this question. Yes, we're not going to pick winners and losers, but it's a fair question. I mean, look, we have five channels, and under those channels, there are multiple communities. So we have a dozen different communities. I would say the long-term growth potential for those communities that continue to embrace a hybrid advisor rooted in an advisory core, but it is a hybrid, you know, sort of business model that the advisor is delivering out to the end consumer, is going to be the most successful, whether that's in 1099 form or in W-2 RIA form. So, you know, that's, you know, three and a half of our channels today without getting into the weeds. So, we're bullish on all of them, you know, just to be blunt. I think there's great secular momentum behind the growth of all five of our channels. But you will see us continue to invest in the virtue and the, you know, the impact of a hybrid value proposition, regardless of legal form of the business, you know.
Fantastic. I mean, yeah, we're out of time basically. So we don't have to worry about coming up with any further questions, but Mike, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming.
Joining
in.
Us.
Thank you.
And for agreeing to
happy
be
holidays.
Peppered all this. Yeah. Happy holidays. And, well, we'll wrap it up there, listener. So thank you, as ever, for tuning in. And we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.